Atlantic City's losing streak just got worse. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration has decided to put the financially struggling resort town under state control. And as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it starts a new chapter for Atlantic City.
Local officials had been fighting a state takeover for months, but now it's a done deal. And the question becomes, what's next?
It's a road we're on that is a newly paved road, and we don't know where the turns are.
Mark Pfeiffer studies local government at Rutgers Blaustein School. He says New Jersey has never assumed such drastic powers to repair a city's finances before.
There's a lot of uncertainties coming along. We don't know what the state's plan is on how they are going to use the authority under the law. We don't know a lot of things.
What we do know are the powers at the disposal of the state as it tries to close a $100 million budget hole and pay off $500 million in debt. State officials will be able to break union contracts, hire and fire city workers, and overturn city council decisions. New Jersey League of Municipalities Director Michael Darcy says the state will also be able to sell off city assets.
So that's very strong medicine. They come in and sell a football field, a recreation field, a hiking trail. Those people have developed that asset over time to respond to the needs of the community, but the decision to sell it could be done without the community's input.
The state takeover comes a week after the state rejected a financial rescue plan proposed by Atlantic City officials. Mayor Don Guardian says he intends to work with the state during the takeover, which could last up to 5 years. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
It was as much a vote against the politics as usual as it was a vote for him. He represents the hope of change.
He politically might not be intelligent, but financially, to bring us out of debt, I think he's the one that will do it.
It's still kind of like a maybe like a numbing shock.
I'm trying to follow Michelle Obama's example and message. When things are low, we go high.
Trump supporters David Deem and Laurie Sanchez and Clinton supporters Russ Heckman and Carmen Fabo San Miguel reacting to last night's stunning Trump victory. Concern over immigration was one of the issues that drove Trump supporters to the polls. Naomi Starobin, Keystone Crossroads editor and host of the WHYY podcast Grapple, spoke with Daniel Hopkins, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, about what drove some of those concerns.
This is a question that I've done a lot of research on. And overall, research suggests that attitudes towards immigration are not strongly grounded in job market concerns. The question then is, what is it? And one possibility is that it's more symbolic, that it's a set of concerns about how immigration is reshaping what it means to be American. And scholars who adopt that view often will point to concerns around, for instance, language. That if you talk to Americans about immigration, one of the first things that comes up is often the use of Spanish or other non-English languages, and that is a source of real concern, and I think is indicative of many Americans thinking that immigration makes it harder for us to stay united as a people.
You hinted that the rate of assimilation and certainly the rate of immigration is similar to other waves that have happened in the last century and before, Irish immigration, Italian immigration. So why does this feel so different, or why are people reacting so differently now?
I would argue that reactions today are in some important ways very similar to those. So we had significant waves of immigration in the, in the 1840s and 1850s, then in the 1880s and 1890s. And the immigration in the 1880s and 1890s included a lot of people from Southern Europe, so Italians, also from Eastern Europe, Jewish immigrants, Polish immigrants. And they were met with fierce hostility. And their arrival catalyzed a profound anti-immigrant movement in American politics that culminated in three different immigration acts that essentially, that dramatically restricted immigration outside of the Western Hemisphere from the 1920s until 1965. So I think what many of us, in light of Donald Trump's stunning victory last night, I think what many of us are now wondering is, have we reached 1921? Have we reached 1924? Have we reached a point when American public policy is going to turn dramatically against continued immigration?
You can hear more of Daniel Hopkins' interview next Wednesday on the podcast Grapple, produced by Keystone Crossroads and Cuvenda Media. Donald Trump's path to victory in Pennsylvania came down to a handful of extremely competitive counties, including Lehigh. WHYY's Bobby Allen spoke to conservative voters there about how Trump became the first GOP presidential candidate to capture the state since 1988.
The white-knuckle wait for returns ended with Trump defeating Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania by one percentage point. It was a narrow victory. But Trump's win in contested counties pushed him over the edge. In Lehigh County, for instance, he won by just about 7,000 votes. Jeff Kimskin, an immigration attorney in Allentown, says Trump winning the state echoed Britain's rejection of the European Union, or Brexit.
I think it's exactly parallel. And I think it's a big middle finger to a lot of things.
He says Trump's appeal to white working-class voters wasn't accidental.
And I think that the concerns of those who gave that middle finger have to be taken into consideration more now, maybe, than they were in the past.
Leslie Springgob is a 19-year-old student at Kutztown University.
The thing that really riled up the electorate, speaking what's on people's minds, getting that instant reaction.
Another Lehigh Valley voter, Karen Rice, says one issue in particular drove her to the polls.
Definitely pro-life. Conception, that's where life begins.
When she realized Trump won, she was thrilled.
We just need something new here. We need something back. Bring back America, right? Bring back America.
Zimskind, meanwhile, says the fact that stock markets rallied the day after Trump's win is another way he was reminded of Brexit.
And over there, the markets tanked and everybody foresaw doom. And then after a week or two, things started to stabilize as people thought about, all right, well, how is this actually going to work? We shall see.
That we shall. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Pennsylvania does not have a voter ID law. Still, some going to vote in the Philadelphia region yesterday encountered poll workers asking all voters for identification. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports the state considers that practice voter intimidation.
Election lawyer Larry Otter says he was distressed to see a long line snaking out the door at a polling place in the Newtown Township Administrative Building in Bucks County. But he was more distressed to see the judge of elections at the front of that line with a list of names.
He was asking everyone for an ID, everyone, which is absolutely illegal.
Otter says he was about to file a legal complaint when the election judge stopped demanding identification. County Director of Elections Dina Dean says she doesn't know exactly what the intent was at the Newtown polling place, but there's only one circumstance when workers are allowed to ask for ID.
They're only permitted to ask a voter that's voting for the first time in an election district.
The Pennsylvania Department of State voter ID requirements explicitly say poll workers should not ask every voter for proof of identification. Still, lingering confusion over the voter ID law scrapped a few years ago seems to have left some poll workers under the impression it is within their rights. Election Judge John Lutz of Cheltenham's 7th Ward says his poll workers do it to speed up the process.
It shows you the spelling of the name, and it just makes the girl, because you come in, you announce your name, it just makes it easier for her to write it in the book, because they have to find it.
It's not clear how many polling places were asking for ID across the board Tuesday, or if voters were turned away. Dean says it's rare. She says she had to tell two places in Bucks County to stop asking for IDs on election day. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Still ahead this evening, there's a call out to designers and developers to turn ideas into working innovations.
We want to encourage people to get to the point where they have a working prototype that can then be the centerpiece for what they want to do with it afterwards.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Back to NewsWorks Tonight, I'm Dave Heller. Homicides in Camden, New Jersey have soared this year, up 28% in the first 9 months of 2016 compared to last year. Yet, overall crime is down slightly. Those numbers don't tell the whole story in this long, struggling city. The police department has been through big changes over the past few years, including dramatic efforts to change the department's culture. WHYY's Elizabeth Fiedler offers this story about those departmental changes and how they may have impacted an incident last year that bears striking similarities to a fatal police shooting of a Chicago teen that touched off months of protests there.
My name is Officer Davis, and Officer Cabrera Davis, and what we're looking at is the Crown Fried Chicken.
There stood 48-year-old Brian Garrett just outside the Crown Fried Chicken at the busy corner of Broadway and Mickle, waving a knife. Cabrera, the police officer, is a friendly woman who grew up in Camden. She knows its dangers, and she was one of several officers to show up on the scene in the heart of the city. He just threatened to kill someone inside the Crown Fried.
Me at 53 and a 52, Broadway and Mickle, Crown Fried.
When I got out of my patrol vehicle, he looked at me and I could see his face and his eyes were like bugged out of his head and I could see he wasn't, you know, mentally stable.
That's Chris Devlin.
We could have used deadly force. You know, that's always the last resort for us and, you know, it's not something that we like to jump to right away. But, you know, one of my concerns, and I know some of the other officers, was there's people in these stores. If he turns and goes into these stores with these people in there with a knife, now we have a hostage situation.
Chris often patrols on foot. Since Camden's old force disbanded in 2012 and was replaced by this new county force, everybody just calls it Metro, longtime residents can't get over how often they see Metro out of their cars, walking, talking to neighbors, no warrants to serve, just chatting. This is astonishing. In a city where a few years ago police stopped showing up at traffic accidents without injuries, there just weren't enough cops. Then in May 2013, the city dissolved its police force and started a new one. In May of 2015, the chief got a personal shout-out from Barack Obama when the president came to Camden to tout the early success of the Metro Force. Murders cut in half over 2 years. Violent crime down a quarter. Those were impressive numbers, and in Camden, it felt remarkable. But to Police Chief Scott Thompson, statistics aren't even the most important signs of progress.
What I tell my officers is, I don't care how many tickets you're writing when you're out there. What I want to see in your area of responsibility when I drive down the street is I want to see little kids playing in front of their house. I want to see people sitting on their front steps.
And the nightly protests in Ferguson, Missouri over a deadly police shooting are not letting up.
Those famous images from Ferguson, Missouri of police armed to the teeth battling citizens in the streets and clashes in other cities, they bothered him.
And some of the progress we think that we have made, particularly in our most challenged communities and our communities of color over the last 3 decades, give us a moment of pause in which maybe we haven't made as much progress as we think we have made.
Instead of cracking down hard and trying to arrest his way out of the city's massive crime problem, the chiefs implemented a program called Ethical Protector.
Our objective is just not to ensure that the officer goes home at the end of their shift, but that everybody goes home and is able to be returned to their loved one. Our officers know that they are not judge, jury, or executioner. They are there to stabilize situations and to help people. We are guardians. We are not warriors.
Back outside the Crown Fried Chicken, Officer Cabrera Davis was about to put that ethical protector training to use when it matters the most, the moment of crisis.
That training, I guess, it gives you a level of confidence because it's like, okay, it forces you to take a step back mentally and look at the situation and figure out what the best possible approach is and what's the safest approach.
Drop the knife. Sir, drop the knife.
That's Officer Chris Devlin.
Sir, drop the knife.
He's right behind the man with the knife.
Sir, I'm telling you, drop the knife or I'm going to tase you.
You can feel the tension in the air watching the video. But unlike officers in other cities whose crisis moment choices have resulted in headlines, the Camden officers do not pull their guns.
Drop the knife. Sir, drop the knife.
The weird thing about watching this video is how slowly, almost leisurely, the scene plays out.
And this whole time we're just talking to him, you know, trying to get him to drop the knife, trying to put people out of harm's way. It's nerve-wracking because you don't know what's going to happen.
About 2 blocks in, Chris Devlin fires his taser. But it doesn't penetrate the man's thick jacket. I didn't realize before Chris told me that you're physically connected to whoever you fired your taser at. So Chris, the cop, is just a few feet away from the man with the knife, and he's physically connected to him, forced to weave back and forth, dodging cars and trees, following him.
So it feels like you're stuck in time almost, and you just want it to come to an end.
We're nearly 6 minutes into the video now. Things are about to turn chaotic. They're blurry glimpses of moving bodies. It's very hard to tell what's going on. And then...
all of a sudden, he dropped the knife. We heard it hit the ground, and we immediately took him to the ground and put him in handcuffs. It could have ended very differently, and it could have ended badly, but, you know, everyone kept their calm and kept poised.
For WHYY News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
WHYY's Radio Times will have more of Elizabeth Fiedler's reporting from Camden tomorrow morning at 11. The call goes out to designers and developers with a passion for turning ideas into working innovations. Here to answer the call is Nick Gunther, lead organizer for Philadelphia Startup Weekend. Nick, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is Philadelphia Startup Weekend?
Philadelphia Startup Weekend is an immersive three-day event where participants can go from idea to something real. Throughout the weekend, participants will work with a great group of mentors, other teammates, and they'll go from idea to sketching out something and hopefully into a working prototype.
Let's make the idea real. Give us an example.
All right. So in 2014, I was a participant, and that was the first time that I got involved with Startup Weekend. And I had this idea that I wanted to pitch just because I wanted to contribute to pitch an idea, but also because I thought it might be something that was untouched before. So I pitched an idea for a funeral arranging application, and this was a web application that would be very much like a checkout. It would have a workflow. You would go in. You would be required, unfortunately, to arrange a funeral. And you, being a person that might not be familiar with it, would be faced with the daunting task of arranging. So what we had in mind was an application that would service that need.
So again, Philadelphia Startup Weekend is not conducted in a laboratory or a classroom. Where do you go to pitch your ideas?
This year for Philadelphia Startup Weekend, it is going to be hosted at a co-working space in Center City, located on 24th and Walnut. It's called City Coho. It's a great facility that will have offices available for people to attend. We will put them up in their own office throughout the weekend. They will, and their teammates, will have this space to work out of all day Sunday, all day Saturday, and Friday evening.
What are the parameters for valid ideas?
It's very open, but the one requirement that we have is that people have not done a lot of work on an idea. They cannot come in there with a working prototype. They can't come in with a lot of sketches about the idea. They have an idea in mind, and we want to make this event a three-day workshop for them to just totally build on that in the boundary of those 3 days.
Is it a matter of coming with an idea, having it reviewed, and then out the door you go, or does it require a deeper dive that utilizes the entire weekend?
It typically will require work afterwards. This three-day event is designed to get you off the ground and then working on something. In my case, I did not continue to work on this idea, but I did meet my partner and my co-founder now of a project that I have been working on since then. So the weekend taught me the skills of what it takes to build something in a very confined space. But I was able to use that knowledge to now apply to something that I'm working on myself.
Contrast participating in Philadelphia Startup Weekend versus learning about advancing one's idea either in a classroom setting or learning online.
I would say that Startup Weekend is very different from the courses that you might get online. You, if you were to take a course online, will get into the very specific details about what it is you're building, the tools required to build that product. If you are a developer, you will get into the very specific details about how to develop something. Startup Weekend is very immersive. 3 days, we give you mentorship opportunities throughout the weekend, but we don't necessarily go into the very specifics of this is how you form a company. These are the documents that you need to file. These are the specific tools that you'll use within your coding application. We like people to figure that out themselves as they're building. So we definitely focus on building and prototyping. We don't require people to build something 100% functional. We want to encourage people to get to the point where they have a working prototype that can then be the centerpiece for what they want to do with it afterwards.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight, and best of luck with your idea moving forward as well.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Nick Gunther, lead organizer for Philadelphia Startup Weekend, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. When a large energy company got a tax break in 2014 to move to Camden, local officials were thrilled at the prospect of hundreds of new jobs. Then critics questioned both the promised jobs and the intended product. We'll hear about that tomorrow evening. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.